And welcome again to Brew Crew Online. I am Benjamin Orr.
I'm Colin Bennett.
And this is our last show of the regular season, which it isn't the regular season anymore, but, you know, I mean, last show about the regular season.
Yeah, a day later, so it's okay.
Yeah, you know. The Brewers on the season finished 83-79, a lot better than what we had expected, you know, from that first half and even the second half. We had a lot of people that, surprised us on how well they did. Aramis Ramirez by far had his best season in the big leagues. Norichika Aoki came over from Japan and did really well. In the starting rotation, Marco Estrada started to really impress us. Mike Fiers started to impress us and just kind of forgot how to pitch. But overall, I think he was rather successful in 2012. It was a lot of ups and downs, more so in the downtrend from the get-go, but the Brewers played strong in the last month and a half, and I think that really speaks a testament to that they're a never-say-die team.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking at their month-by-month totals, their win-loss by month, like you said, overall 83-79. It's a 500 season. You can't really be upset with a winning year, despite how close it came to the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
They had a much better home record than they did road record again this year. They had almost a little bit over a 600 winning percentage at home, and then they were about 13 games under 500 on the road. But you look at how they did, you know, April, May, June, and July. You have 11-12 in April, and then 12 wins each in May, June, and July, with 16 losses in May and 14 losses each in June and July. And then August comes around, and they have their first winning month of the year at 16-12, and then just go on that tear through September where they're 18-10, fantastic record through the month, and then finish out October 2-1.
Yeah, it was really impressive to see how the Brewers could, you know, literally flip a switch and become this team that we had seen last year, you know, obviously minus Fielder and minus a few bullpen guys. It was still really impressive because you had Aramis Ramirez, who really nicely fitted in after Braun in the lineup. You had Axford, who got how many saves in a row?
Right.
You had the bullpen that, aside from, like, Manny Parra and Jose Barrios, looked really well. And Livian Hernandez had a few blow-ups here and there. I think he had a 5-run affair in one of the games. And it showed us a lot of guys that I'm comfortable with going forward in this bullpen, like Brandon Kinsler and Jim Henderson. I feel like they should be a part of it. Willie Peralta, it's going to be interesting to see how he bounces back from being shut down for the season. I think the Brewers into next year, they can carry this fire, they can carry this momentum that they had, because I don't know what the heck, basically every month, but end of August and September was. I don't know what that was. I don't want to know what that was. It was not the Brewers we knew. I mean, we knew the Brewers had so much more potential than that. Was it part of injuries? Yeah. I mean, we had Lucroy out for a long time. We had Gamel out since May. We had Chris Norrison out since God knows when, I think April or May. And we had Alex Gonzalez out since April and May. Injuries factored into it. Markham got hurt at a point. So do we say injuries ruin the season? Not necessarily, because we had guys to fill in those roles. But all around, injuries do add to it.
I think it was obvious from the beginning that the Brewers did not have the depth that we wish they had.
Yeah.
Throughout, you know, the bullpen and on the bench just in general. When Lucroy went down, I mean, Martin Maldonado and George Gutierrez picked up really well. And it was nice to see. And obviously, Corey Hart taking over at first base went really well. But you look at the year that, you know, Nigel Morgan had. I mean, 239 on the year for 122 games, just could never really get it together. Travis Ishikawa did well as a backup, but nothing really to write home about.
Mm-mm.
And even George Gutierrez started out well, started out really, really well, actually. But then, I mean, nothing really happened after that. And then you have Jeff Bianchi and Cody Ransom and Taylor Green, who are all never made it above 200 on the year.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest things to add to that, really one of the biggest disappointments of 2012, was Ricky Weeks, hands down.
Yeah.
Just a very, very poor season for Ricky Weeks. He really stepped it up in the last month, or month and a half and two. But other than that, it was just, you never like to say one player makes a team or one player makes a difference, but to see Ricky Weeks struggle so mightily, it really kind of did in a sense, because, yeah, the Brewers could have scored 8 runs and lost, you know, 9-8, but if they would have had those 2 extra runs, I mean, they would have won 10-9. So, it's really hard to say whether or not you blame those kind of losses on the bullpen, on the starting pitching, or even portions of the offense that was struggling, but I know if Ricky Weeks had turned it around this season, you know, at least a little bit earlier than what he did, the Brewers would have probably been playing for the game tonight against Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely part of it. I mean, defensively, he had one of his better years, although, depending on how you're looking at defense, Ricky Weeks is either an incredible asset to your team, or he's right around average. But at the same time, I mean, 157 games, and he gives you a .230 average, 63 RBIs, which is pretty good. Still managed 20 homers. I mean, it's weird. It's like for everything that he could have done really, really well, there were so many disappointing parts of it. And that beginning half of the season was, you know, one of the worst I think anyone's ever seen out of a regular Brewers player.
Yeah, and I think what really hurt him was the fact that he was striking out a heck of a lot more than in 2011. In 2011, he struck out 107 times, whereas in 2012, he struck out 169 times.
Right.
I mean, obviously, he did play fewer games in 2011, but he still managed to have a decent season, 20 home runs, 49 RBIs, whereas in 2012, he had 21 home runs and 63 RBIs. You know, it's really hard to tell with Ricky how he's going to do for your team.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, I don't like to pin it all on one player, because Corey Hart did struggle at some point in the season as well, and he finally turned it around. So, I think it was a combination of those two, Niger Morgan really not doing well, but Carlos Gomez picked up really nicely where in the departments that Niger Morgan was slacking. So, I mean,
yeah,
you kind of had it balance out a little bit, not too much, but it was enough to say, going forward, I think Carlos Gomez is going to be the center fielder.
Yeah, Carlos Gomez looking ahead is definitely, I think he has to be your everyday center fielder. I mean, at some point, Niger Morgan is not giving you what he did last year, and I mean, he's not making a ton of money. You don't need to drop him for any salary cap reasons necessarily. But at some point, like, he's wasting space on that field at some point.
You want to know an interesting fact about Carlos Gomez?
Of course I do.
Played in 20 less games than Ricky Weeks and had 2 less homers than Ricky Weeks. He had 19. And Ricky Weeks had 21.
Wow.
And he had 12 plus RBIs, too.
He really picked his...
I mean, you look at the last week. You look at the last week of the season, and Carlos Gomez had 3 home runs. He, in my mind, does not register as a home run hitter. And for him to do that, I mean, come on. I mean, he was hitting at .393 in the last 8 games of the season. You know, stolen bases galore. Had 37 on the season. it was just incredible to get that kind of speedy production out of him, and even get some power out of him.
Yeah, and, you know, Carlos Gomez has always wanted to be a natural power hitter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's always had his swing built to try to take things out of the park. You see that, you know, he has that little uppercut in his swing, and he's definitely from the heels on every play. and so, really, to the credit of the coaching staff, they've just kind of let him be who he wants to be, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. and but helped him to be a more effective power hitter, and I think we've seen that this year. And if he can get that more consistent going into 2013, I think you have a bona fide star in your hands.
Yeah, I mean, he may not be the biggest name star, but I mean, he's still going to be somebody that is going to put fear into the opposing, you know, pitching staffs. He's going to be somebody that if a guy hits it into a gap, that Carlos Gomez is going to be out there and dive for that ball and get it and make it out. He's going to be the guy that robs people of home runs. I mean, you have a combination of him, Ryan Braun, and Norichika Aoki in the outfield. It's going to be – there aren't going to be a heck of a lot of extra base hits unless it's hit off the wall. And even then, I mean, you have them right there probably to jump up and try and get it. So, I mean, there's a lot of
the only thing that would concern me about – I mean, the only thing there is to say about that that outfield, too, is just that, you know, Aoki doesn't have as strong an arm as the other two, but I think he more than makes up for it with his bat and his speed around the bases.
Yeah, and even his speed in the outfield is still really nice as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the fact that he hit, what, I think it was 10 home runs this season, or 9? 10, actually. Didn't really see that coming from him. You don't really see that coming from any Japanese player that isn't Hideki Matsui. So that was interesting to see that out of him. But, you know, I liked what I saw out of him this year. 288 batting average, you know, had a ton of extra base hits, 37 doubles, 4 triples. I was really impressed with him. I really was.
Yeah, and I think he definitely benefited from the move that Corey had to make to first base. You hate to say that there's any silver lining to an injury or good things that come out of season-ending injury, but more so than Hart moving to first base was Aoki moving to right field. I think it gave us a lot more options in our lineup, added speed to the bases, and really improved our outfield defense.
A heck of a lot of speed, too. 30 stolen bases. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
He really didn't strike out all that much, too. Only 55 strikeouts, 43 walks, so he's a very patient hitter, as you can tell.
Yeah.
81 runs scored, 50 RBIs. You know, I know we probably, as fans, you know, went, we want more out of him. Well, you can only get so much out of a rookie season. And to really want more out of Aoki is kind of asking for too much, because you had to take in, obviously, like his defensive play into mind, but you have to take the speed around the bases into mind, and he's not going to be the guy, he's not going to be, you know, a Ryan Braun 30-100 every year. He might give you the 10 to 12 home runs, depending on it, maybe the 50 to 60 RBIs, but he's going to give you a lot of stolen bases, though.
Yeah. I mean, Aoki can slap the ball pretty good. I mean, he can really turn on it as well. But his... A home run is the very, very, very edge of his power. I was at a game earlier in the season where they played the Cubs, and he hit 2 home runs that game, one of them being a walk-off. And, yeah, I mean, they just floated over that back edge of the wall. They were right there. But it's nice to see that he's got that – he has that power potential, even though it's probably not getting any higher. The fact that he can hit for power and do, you know, and hit for contact, really, is always nice to see.
Yeah, 150 hits this season. He's a really pure contact hitter. And that's a great way to start off your rookie season in America. And probably one of the better pickups by the Brewers in the offseason.
Yeah.
And somebody I definitely think going forward we need to try and keep. He's definitely going to be a vital part of this club. You know, you hate to see somebody like him go, but I don't think we will. I think he really impressed Ron Manicke and Doug Melvin. I really think he impressed the Brewers fans in general, and I think they would hate to see somebody like him go, see that talent slip through their fingers.
Right.
You know, the Brewers season was just so many, like, kind of like a roller coaster ride. It really took a lot.
It absolutely was.
It took a lot of different turns. I mean, there are points where the Brewers would win 4 games in a row, talking about the series with the Dodgers, and then they lost, 9 in a row in that awful stretch in July.
Right. Or
seven in a row, my bad. But, I mean, they hadn't lost more than four in a row the entire season, and they hit that skidding point in July and just fall apart. I mean, it was funny. The Brewers would have times where they would win four games in a row. They won two against Arizona, two against Miami in a four-game thing, transitioning from those series. And then they would lose four games in a row right before it. And, I mean, it was just really weird to see the Brewers win so many and then lose so many and then win so many. It wasn't like they'd win two, then lose one, or, like, win one, then lose one. They would, like, do all or nothing.
It seemed like that at times, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did.
You know, breaking it down by series, there weren't... I mean, where it really hurt the team was four-game series. We couldn't seem to win. We had no problem. You know, we've beaten St. Louis and Pittsburgh, the Dodgers, Houston, obviously, we beat up on. The Cubs, we went 13-4 against. Pittsburgh, we went 11-4 against. So you can thank the Brewers, Pittsburgh fans, for the reason you have a losing season.
Love you guys.
Yeah, you almost made it. But, you know, the four-game sets, we always seem to just split them, and those became so important, especially around July when we split that series with Miami.
Mm-hmm.
There we were only six games back after that second game, and then we lose the last two games in a row, and we're right back to eight games out.
Yeah, and it just... It looked really hopeless at some points for the Brewers. It really did, because you can only be so many games under 500 to where the season you just feel a shot, and then for them to just like literally become this new team and just start winning series, sweeping Atlanta, taking 2 out of 3 from the Cardinals at St. Louis, sweeping the Pirates, taking 2 out of 4 from the Nationals, It was a lot of good play, and, obviously that four-game series we had against the Nationals in late September took 2 out of 4. Neither one of the losses were even close. We lost 10-4 against Gio Gonzalez, and then 12-2 against Jordan Zimmermann. There were a lot of really good games of the Brewers, and there were a lot of really bad games at really bad times. So, I think this is more of an experiment, really. You're experimenting without Prince Fielder. You're experimenting with injuries, what it's like. You're testing your depth, really, of who you have, pitching-wise and offense-wise. We had to bring up Martin Maldonado. We had to use Travis Ishikawa at some points. We had to switch Corey Hart to first. And then even in the rotation, we had to pitch Mike Fiers. We had to pitch Marco Estrada. We had to pitch Willie Peralta and Mark Rogers. Guys we weren't ready to really pitch. Guys we weren't really ready to bring up, and they did fine for the most part. And, I think that speaks a lot about the potential that a lot of these guys had beforehand. Like Fiers, I think, being an older prospect, it makes you wonder if he could have started 2 or 3 years earlier what it would have been like. But it's hard to say. But, I think looking at now, we know how good our depth is. It speaks a lot if we have any more major injuries.
Yeah, I think so. I think in terms of pitching depth, we're definitely there. In terms of infield and outfield depth, there are people that I'm curious about. There are people that I'm interested in. however, we still need a real utility, like middle infielder, who's going to produce really good results. I know we only saw Schaefer for a little bit, but I like him in the outfield. The Brooks Conrad era was a disaster. people like Taylor Green and Edwin Maisonette, I mean, really don't have a choice anymore. They're getting up there. They're definitely getting up there in age for someone who hasn't been on a major league roster yet. To say the same for Jeff Bianchi. And it's at some point, you really need to see consistent production out of them, even as a utility player.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, he didn't mean to hurt your feelings about Brooks Conrad. He didn't really mean that.
Yes, I did. Brooks Conrad, terrible.
Yeah, he was pretty bad. That is really fair to say out of them. Guys like Bianchi, guys like Schaefer, to see a more consistent production out of them, yeah, obviously they're not going to play every day. They're going to play, you know, every third or maybe every fifth day, and maybe be inserted if a guy is, you know, if Braun was, say, out for a few days with maybe like an ankle or injury or something. You know, yeah, then you'd play Schaefer, you know, out in the outfield, or if Ricky Weeks is hurt for a little bit, yeah, you'd place Bianchi there or Taylor Green there. But, yeah, I think at least demanding a consistent production from them when they're in isn't too much to ask for, considering they don't play every day. I think that's fair enough, because when you have Jeff Bianchi going 0-8 to start his major league career, and he gets sent back down, and he comes back up, you know, that speaks a lot to the fact that some of these guys may not be ready. You know, some of them are, some of them aren't. Bianchi, on the other hand, he needs to get his act together if he's going to try and be up here. You know, he's 26. He's not really getting any younger. So, I mean, he has to have his time to get up here. He's going to be into his prime soon.
Absolutely. And I like his power potential. Obviously, he had three home runs and two doubles, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Out of, what, 13 hits?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, the swing is there. The power's there. He, like so many prospects, he has a ton of potential, but it's just like, when is he going to put that into consistent motion? And I don't know what it is. Maybe he's just not used to major league caliber pitching. But, I mean, I'm sure he's going to get a shot in spring training to really, really try to get something done this year.
Yeah, because even if he's not on the club, you know, heading into 2013, he still has a chance to see a lot of it, like you said, in spring training. He'll have a really, you know, either good, difficult, or very medium time with it, because, you know, they're going to be pitching, other teams are going to be pitching, you know, their aces for maybe an inning or two or three, and then they're going to be bringing in guys who they want to try to pitch. So it's going to be people he's already faced, you know, in the minor leagues. But for him to at least get, you know, maybe a start against, I don't know, Cliff Lee or somebody like that, and see how these pitchers actually pitch, it's going to be really interesting to see how Bianchi does. Taylor Green, I think, on the other hand, was kind of picking it up a little bit. He was up and down and up. I really don't know what to say about him, honestly. He kind of had the same exact numbers as, oh my God, Bianchi.
Yeah.
My mind just went completely blank. He kind of had the same numbers as Bianchi, but in 40 more at-bats, so that's a little bit concerning.
Right.
So, I don't know. I like Green as a backup infielder for first base, for third base, maybe even short if we had to. But obviously, Segura's got that position really secured up. Maybe Bianchi going short as a backup. Green, though, I think his... God, I think his worth is a little, not downgraded, but kind of like that, because with Eric Ferris, you know, looming in the shadows, possibly at a second base, short backup scenario, it's not leaving a whole heck of a lot of room for Taylor Green.
Right. No, and I mean, that's just the way it works sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When we've been waiting for Taylor Green to be the guy... for a few years now. So, I mean, if he can't do it, someone else is going to, you know what I mean? We had Gene Segura come in and do a really, really nice job. A very deft glove at shortstop, and he's turning on the ball well. He's doing a good job stretching infield hits and stretching, you know, close hits in the outfield. I think he's our guy going forward. Taylor Green, like you said, could be a decent utility guy, but I think there's enough people coming up behind him that you're going to have pretty good competition going into spring training.
Yeah, because we've talked before, we'll probably talk again in a later podcast about off-season moves and what you do with Gamble and Hart, things like that. But, I mean, even if we keep both of them, then that really limits Taylor Green's chances, because one of them's going to be starting, one of them's going to be the backup. In this case, I think probably Hart would start and Gamble would be the backup again.
Right.
But, you know, do you put Taylor Green at third? I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different questions there. He's played second before. I think he's played third a little bit. So obviously he has the range to throw.
He's listed as the third baseman, so...
So he has obvious range to throw from third to first, and even third to second. But a lot of people don't count on third being a hot corner, and it really is. There's a lot of sharp balls hit to third base, and can he field those as well as Ramos Ramirez? That's a huge question that we'll be finding ourselves, you know, asking a lot heading into spring training.
It's right.
How can Taylor Green not only handle big league pitching, but big league hitting and big league, you know, plays defensively?
Yeah. I think the best way to do it, if I were running it, I would say Corey Hart's your first baseman. Matt Gammel's your, like, every 10th game guy. And he can, you know, when Corey Hart's tired, if there's an injury, he goes there. He could probably play third if they needed him to. But Taylor Green's probably your backup to Ramirez at third. And Matt Gammel and Green become basically utility guys, although Green would get more usage probably.
You know, I think what you could do with Matt Gammel, though, just speaking on this really quickly, is even maybe transition to the outfield. You know, if Nori needs a day off, or if Gomez needs a day off, you put Nori in center, you put Gammel in right. I mean, you could try to even transition him out there a little bit, get him more versatile. Right. So, I mean, that really couldn't hurt to try and, you know... I mean, we had to deal with the Corey Hart. You know, we had to take him from right to first. I mean, he did play first before a little bit. So, I mean, he's had a little bit of experience there, but it'll really test us and, you know, and show us how good Gamble's arm really is and how accurate it actually is, if we even want to try to put him at third. Because, I mean, that takes a strong, accurate throw as well, and that's what a lot of people kind of fail to realize. They just think, oh, you know, you just toss it over to first. Well, you have to be accurate about it, or else you're going to throw it into the stands.
Right.
So, well, I think another portion we want to get into today is just really quick, our pitcher and hitter of the year. It's a segment we've done, you know, obviously every podcast, our pitcher and hitter of the week, and now it's our pitcher and hitter of the year, which before we even say who they are, I think it's going to be pretty unanimous right now. But, Colin, you want to start us off with your pitcher of the year?
My pitcher of the year. Ooh. You know, you have to go with Yovani Gallardo, I think. I mean, a 16-win season, coming off the start of the year that he had.
Yeah.
204 strikeouts. He just did a phenomenal job going in the second half of the season, and I don't think we could have asked for anything more out of him.
That is who my pitcher of the year is Yovani Gallardo. You know, because he had a really terrible ERA to start off the season. I think even heading into, like, June, it was, like, 4-something. But that was only really because of the two terrible outings he had against the Cardinals. And other than that, he looked phenomenal. Really getting strong towards the end of the season. He won, I think, what, like, 8 or few in a row? Or at least the Brewers won 8 decisions that he pitched in.
Yes.
It was incredible what we saw of Yovani Gallardo. Really kind of all season, but especially towards the latter half of it. Very strong pitcher. His fourth 200 or more strikeout season. And he's only 26. That was what is so impressive about him. He has such great command, such dominant stuff. You know, he's a really, you know, decent pitcher. And he's only 26. I mean, that speaks a lot about him. It really
Absolutely.
Does.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a guy for the next 5 or 6 years who can do this with regularity. You know, strike out 200 pitcher, strike out 200 batters, win, you know, minimum of 12 games. I mean, you're talking about a guy going down the stretch that might end up being one of the best Brewers pitchers in history.
No doubt in my mind. I mean, that's just the way he just shuts down lineups, and the fact that he can strike out, you know, 7 to 9 guys a game, that's impressive. You really can't ask for much better production out of a pitcher than that.
Right.
You know, just so good this season. Really kind of the anchor in the Brewers rotation, because they had to do so many different things with it, with the injuries and all, and different guys struggling, different guys being gone, Zach Greinke trade, you know, things like that. lot of adversity in this rotation, but Gallardo stood strong, and he really showed that he's the captain of this rotation.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter who you get, who you bring back in free agency, who you sign in free agency, your ace of the Milwaukee Brewers is Yovani Gallardo until someone can do what it is that he does for this team.
Yeah, and I don't really see that happening anytime soon, certainly. It could happen in the next, you know, 3-4 years. But even then, Yovani Gallardo is still going to dominate lineups. I mean, he's not going anywhere. This is going to be a pitcher that the Brewers are going to hold on to for a very long time. And he's going to be a pitcher that, still in my mind, is going to go under the radar. And the only reason is because his ERA isn't, you know, like 3 or 2.9. And, you know, would it be nice? Yeah. But it's not like his ERA is terrible. 3.66 this year, 3.63 in his career. It's not that it's a terrible ERA. It's just because he has some blow-up games against the Cardinals that really inflate his ERA. I mean, that's really it.
Yeah, I mean, if you can settle out what it is he does against St. Louis, you have a completely different story in your hands with him.
Yeah, you have a guy who's probably in the Cy Young every year. Or just
right.
That's just Milwaukee bias, but... switching to the bats now, offensively... I mean, if you followed the Brewers at all, even for like 3 games this season, you have to know that Ryan Braun has to be the hitter of the year. Possible MVP, probably won't get it. And if he doesn't, I think the person that should get it is Buster Posey, but we'll get into that some other time.
probably just a little bit later on this.
Yeah.
Ryan Braun is definitely your batter of the year, your player of the year, your Milwaukee Brewer of the present and future. yeah. I mean, just a phenomenal year. 41 home runs, 30 stolen bases. He's first Brewer ever to have a 40-30 year. He's the first Brewer, the first Milwaukee baseball player, including, you know, Eddie Matthews, Hank Aaron, all those excellent Braves, the only one to make multiple appearances on the 30-30 club. I mean, it's a stellar year for him. I think arguments can be made in terms of value on this team for Ramos Ramirez batting behind Braun and the numbers he put up: 50 doubles, 27 homers of his own, 105 RBIs of his own, a 360 on base percentage, 901 is OPS. I mean, he had a phenomenal year as well, and then you can't discount what Aoki and Hart and Jonathan Lucroy did as well, who ended as the team's batting leader, despite being out for an entire month.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just a lot, and I mean a lot, to like about Ryan Braun. Aside from the fact that he was 3 behind Chase Headley in RBIs and under Buster Posey and Andrew McCutchen for batting average, he basically led in everything else. First in home runs, first in runs scored, first in slugging percentage, first in OPS, and this is obviously all, of course, in the NL, not the entirety of baseball. Fifth in stolen bases, you know, second in RBIs, third in batting average. I mean, there is not a guy that the Brewers have seen, I guess, aside from Fielder, in a long-term, you know, time, that has given them the consistent production offensively that Ryan Braun has, and really good production at that. The 40-30 season is what is really impressive to me. Because typically you think power guys, I think, you know, your Josh Hamiltons, your Miguel Cabreras, things like that, aren't really your base dealers. And
right.
Ron proves I'm wrong. 30 stolen bases, back-to-back 30-30 seasons, 112 RBIs. It's just, if he doesn't win the ML MVP, which he probably won't because the Brewers aren't in the playoffs, which I think, I don't want to get into that. I think it's kind of a shame, honestly, and it probably will be because of what happened maybe in the offseason. People think that, or maybe it just is simply the fact that the Brewers didn't make the postseason. I don't know. The Braun thing we're going to talk about in a later show, not really anytime soon.
Right.
So we'll have that for you. But I mean, other than that, it's just, how can you not give Ryan Braun the MVP?
You know, there are going to be some arguments made, about, you know, Posey playing the tougher position, which, yes, that is true. but and he has a better batting average. But remember, he's only leading the National League in batting average because his friend Melky Cabrera in San Francisco decided that he's not going to follow the rules of math anymore.
Yeah.
So he's been removed from existence in all statistical measures. Which, that's a whole other issue that I have. Regardless of how he did it, he had more hits per at-bat than anyone else in the major leagues, and you can't just make that go away. So, no, Posey's not the NL batting leader. Melky Cabrera is. Like, there's good arguments for Posey and for McCutchen and for Ryan Braun and, you know, Yadier Molina, I think. But you look at Posey, who also has, you know, Marco Scudero there. He has Angel Pagan, who had a great year. I mean, you take Posey away from San Francisco and then what Melky did for the entire season for San Francisco. I don't know if he's as valuable. I mean, he's definitely the most valuable catcher, I would think. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the most valuable player in the National League on that team, I don't think so at all. Especially when you also have a pitcher who threw a perfect game.
Yeah, I mean, when you fall into a pitching rotation that's that good. I mean, yeah, Lincecum had an off year, but Zito and Vogelsong just kind of took his place and looked just as good. So there's right. a lot right in San Francisco, and Melky Cabrera was a huge part of that. And you have to wonder where they would be without him, if they would even have the West, or if the Dodgers would have their West.
Exactly.
You really have to wonder how many of those wins were brought on by Melky Cabrera. So that's a huge thing. Obviously, yeah. Posey is a huge part of the Giants, and I'm not discrediting him. But if you are going... Okay, we're looking at this two ways. If there's an MVP race, and you're going based on playoff teams... Then yes, Buster Posey, in my mind, gets it. He has to get it. There's nobody that even comes close. Not even Yadier Molina. If you're going based on not making the playoffs, and you're just going based on how good the player performed overall and how well they were beneficial to their team, then yeah, Ryan Braun wins that hands down. Because you look at the fact that Ryan Braun carried this team for a good month and a half until Ramos Ramirez finally turned on the Jets, Nora Chika Oki turned on the Jets, Corey Hart turned it on. Ryan Braun literally held this team together from falling too far back.
Right.
So him doing that, I think, not only obviously earns him the most valuable player on the Brewers, but the most valuable player in the NL. I mean, there's no way. If they were to factor in that kind of thing, which they obviously don't, then Braun would win that easily.
Right. And well, you know, the voting rules for most valuable player don't leave a definition. They leave it open to the voters' interpretation. And so there are people who are going to think that. It's not like Ryan Braun's going to be off. You know, he's not going to be shunned by Major League Baseball. His positive test was overturned. And he was there with a stellar year. One of the best back-to-back seasons I think any player's had in a long time. I mean, there's no way you can deny some votes to him. Does he get it? I don't know necessarily that he does. But I think he's definitely at the top of the discussion.
Yeah, he at least has to be in that discussion somewhere. Obviously, we would love to see him win it, you know, being Brewers fans. We would love to see that happen for him. But, you know, it's hard to tell with different things. Because, okay, let's say you still factor in the Melky Cabrera thing, and you have him leading. Then is Posey even in the discussion at all?
Right.
So, I mean, there's a lot of questions that can be desired with the whole Melky Cabrera thing, and that, I don't know if it necessarily plays into defining how the MVP race would go, but it certainly is a large portion of it, because you have a lot of things that do that. You have looking at, basically, you would have a top five of Cabrera, Posey, McCutchen, Braun, and Molina. And then you say, okay, well, Melky Cabrera is obviously in contention for the MVP, but then again, so is Ryan Braun and Andrew McCutchen. Okay, now he's gone, so it automatically becomes Buster Posey's teammate. I don't know if I buy into that. I really don't.
Right. Now, in terms of the AL, there's been a big discussion amongst the fan-sided community about this, amongst all of us would-be sports writers, and the AL MVP race between Miguel Cabrera and Mike Trout, which has brought plenty of things into question about what value means to a team. Let's say that it's just that two-horse race, which I don't think is that much of a stretch. Who has it in your...
Verlander.
Mike Trout or Miguel Cabrera?
Justin Verlander. Kidding. honestly, Mike Trout, because the Triple Crown is an award on its own. Which, yes, Miguel Cabrera obviously wins hands down. You know, congratulations to Miguel Cabrera on winning that. That is a huge achievement, something that hasn't been done since 1967 with Carl Yastrzemski. Yes, that is incredible. But Mike Trout, in the same regards, has done so many spectacular things as a rookie. He's, what, 21, I believe? He's done so many things at that age. Stole, I think, 40 bases. Had a 326 average. You know, I have to give it to him, because if you have to factor in anything at all, it has to be defense. And Miguel Cabrera, as we all know, isn't the greatest defender, but man, Mike Trout has some nice plays in the outfield. He really did some nice catches.
He definitely does. I'm gonna, you know, I'm kind of stuck on this one, because I look at the numbers as I see it, and you know, by wins above replacement and win probability added and all of those more advanced metrics, Mike Trout is obviously the superior player this season. But I think you look at Cabrera in a couple ways. Number one, 40 doubles, 44 home runs, 139 RBIs, a 999 OPS, and the fact that he's not a third baseman.
Yeah.
He moved to make room for Prince Fielder to be a part of this team. Now, you can look at other people in the majors, you know, like a Hanley Ramirez, who didn't want to play third base, so Jose Reyes could play shortstop. There's been a number of notable disputes about moving positions. I mean, I think that factors in that he went to a place he knew that he wasn't going to be comfortable because he knew it was best for the team. And with both of those two in that lineup, Detroit's in the playoffs.
But he's played third before, though. He played third 3 years with the Florida Marlins. He played it in 2008 with Detroit. I mean, he's played it before, so it's not like it was a whole entirely new concept to him. I'm not saying that doesn't obviously take a toll, because it's been a few years since he's played the position. But
right.
Looking at the thing that really impresses me, though, between Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera, though, is looking at the number of games played and looking at how some stats Mike Trout is way beyond Miguel Cabrera. And, like, runs scored. He has 129 runs scored in 139 games played, whereas Miguel Cabrera has 109 runs scored in 161 games played.
But how much of runs scored, how much of the runs scored argument is, you know, the other people that had fantastic years in Los Angeles? Not to take anything away from, you know, the rest of Detroit, which also had a very, very good team.
Well, yeah, but Mike Trout set himself in scoring position how many times? He was one steal shy of having 50. He had 49 steals in this season, 67 walks, 182 hits. I mean, really, what is not to like about this kid? I'm not saying that, obviously, he wins at miles above Cabrera.
A vote for him in second place for AL's most valuable player is not liking him.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in my mind, he has to win it, though. I mean, I just don't see it, because if you factor in all the offensive things, yes, obviously Miguel Cabrera had a better offensive year than him. But he played in 30 more games than Mike Trout. You give Mike Trout those 30 other games, and you see how he does. He could be even near Cabrera in that, giving him a run for his money in the Triple Crown in some regards. I mean, Curtis Granderson was one home run shy of tying Cabrera for home runs. So that tells you that Cabrera wasn't...
Hamilton.
Yes, and so it tells you that Cabrera wasn't, you know, miles above everybody else. So, I think if you have to factor in something, which really isn't factored into the MVP race at all, is defense. If it's defense, then Mike Trout wins it easily. Because the triple crown is an award on its own. So, and people will say the same thing last year about Verlander winning it and the Cy Young. But Verlander, I think last year, played better than anybody else in the AL. Whereas this year, I think he has healthy competition with Trout.
I'm not sure the Triple Crown is an award so much on its own as it is an amazing achievement in being able to... By the way, baseball is traditionally measured. He was... I mean, the numbers don't lie. He had more home runs, he had more RBIs, and he had a better batting average than everyone else. Now, you can say, yes, those are kind of outdated metrics in terms of how a player performs on the field, and it doesn't factor in defense, and it factors in as much what the rest of the team does. But he was there to drive in runs every time. He put the ball over the fence more than anyone else. I'm not saying that Trout doesn't have a case. He does have an excellent case, and he will probably win this MVP and more. but what's kind of sad about this is Cabrera did something that an entire lifetime of kids, of baseball fans, had never seen.
Yeah, I mean,
the Triple Crown. I mean, that's stuff that used to guarantee Hall of Fame status. And I'm not railing against, sabermetrics or anything like that at all. What I'm saying is since Cabrera won the Triple Crown, the entire discussion is, well, why shouldn't he get the MVP? Instead of really taking a lot of time and saying, holy crap, he did something that hasn't been done since 1967.
Yeah, and they noted the fact that Omar Vizquel was the only active player alive when that happened. No other player in baseball was alive when that happened.
So, exactly.
That's pretty incredible. But you brought up a point earlier that I wanted to go on a little bit, was the fact that you said Mike Trout was in a lineup that, there are other good hitters. Albert Pujols, Mark Trumbo, Kendrys Morales. But here's the difference, though. Mike Trout scored 129 runs on the season. Miguel Cabrera had 139 RBIs. Now, you might be asking yourself, so what? Well, so what? I mean, that obviously means there are people on base for Miguel Cabrera to hit in, so they had to get on. Whereas in Mike Trout's case, he scored runs. So he could have scored through sack hits, sack flies, bunts. He could have scored through anything that would have gotten an out. It doesn't mean he was necessarily in a better lineup. It means he got himself into scoring position a heck of a lot more than Cabrera did. Cabrera just had the fortunate, ways of batting with, Austin Jackson and Prince Fielder and Brennan Bosch and those kind of type of guys. He had, it was fortunate for him to, be in a lineup with those type of guys. And I'm not discrediting Miguel Cabrera at all. I mean, that is an incredible. And he had 139 RBIs in a season. That is incredible. But you have to look at the fact that I think Mike Trout, he got himself into a position where he could score more and try to help his team win more. Now, did the Angels obviously win more? No, they're not in the playoffs at all. They were nowhere near it. Detroit is. And I'm not saying if Mike Trout wins, it's going to be by flying colors. I mean, he's going to win it by maybe one or two votes. I mean, Miguel Cabrera makes a very interesting case for it, and a lot of people think he locks it up with getting the Triple Crown. But I don't really see it because I like to factor in those little things. And they may be nitpicking sort of things, and I mean, I know. I'll admit that. They may be saying, well, you're just looking at this thing and not that thing. But I don't know. I like Mike Trout because he played in 22 less games than Cabrera, put up some better numbers than Cabrera in some regards, and like I said before, he's 21. I mean, that's incredible. And he's not...
Yeah.
It's
incredible. Yes.
Yeah, and it's not like we're saying, well, he obviously deserves it because how young he is. We're not pulling a Bryce Harper here. Obviously, Mike Trout has earned everything he's done. The Bryce Harper thing just gets on my nerves. Both men make a very interesting case for the MVP. My pick is Mike Trout, obviously. But if Miguel Cabrera wins it, I won't be disappointed. I think he deserves it just as much.
Right.
It's just a matter of who do you think deserves it more. And I think both of them deserve it. It's just Trout deserves it by a hair more.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I don't know how much body of work goes into it. You know, like when they say you know, like Golden Globes and Oscars and stuff, they do look at body of work as well. I think Miguel Cabrera's, if Mike Trout is to win this year, the MVP, I think going forward, they need to look at, I mean, his second year, obviously, what's going to happen when he's an everyday player full time, in the major leagues and everyone has the film on him and everyone knows the spots, you know, is he going to be as good forever? And that's kind of that's not so much a question as to does he deserve the MVP. That's more something that I just want to posit as a discussion, for people to kind of put in the back of their minds as they continue to watch him, going forward.
Well, that's one of those great what if questions though, that you say, well, he could, but he couldn't. You don't know. I mean, Miguel Cabrera could fall flat on his face after this season, which he won't. I really don't think he will.
But then, I think history has proven he won't, but.
Yeah. You know, I don't think Mike Trout will either. You know, he's been able to handle being in the spotlight and doing it well. And at such a young age, he hasn't let it get into his head. You know, he's been able to provide that production for the Angels this year. You know, Trumbo was doing really well and then slipped off. And now Mike Trout really became the face of this team next to Jared Weaver. I don't know. I think it's hard to say with Trout whether or not he'll fall off. This will be an only a year, which I don't think it will. I mean, but I don't know. You play those what if games, and it's so hard to tell. I mean, it really is.
Yeah. No, it definitely. I mean, it definitely is. And I mean, that's really kind of what the MVP is a big what if game.
Yeah, because in the end, you're going to piss off somebody.
Right, and you're saying like, oh well, if Mike Trout was on this team as opposed to this team, if Mike Trout didn't exist, what would the Angels do? And you know, if Miguel Cabrera, you know, I don't know, got his hand bitten off by a lion or something, what happens to the Tigers after that?
Jesus, what are you doing in the off season?
Right, no, but I mean, there's so many questions that come up where you say like, oh, you take. Say in the NL race, you take Ryan Braun out of the Brewers, what do the Brewers do? You take, you know, Todd Frazier out of the Cincinnati Reds, and, you know, does that make a difference on who Rookie of the Year is? I mean, it's something you can't really, you just do your best to try to make the best case for it, but, I mean, legitimately, there's arguments across the board that can hold water.
Yeah, that's very true. You always look at, well, what if they didn't have this guy? How would their team factor in? Like, we were talking about earlier, like, I forget what team we were talking about, but if they didn't have, oh, God, who was it? I think it was the Brewers, yeah. If the Brewers didn't have, like, this consistent production from Braun, or if they didn't have him doing what he did this season, or they didn't have Yovani Gallardo being that clutch pitcher in those certain games, where would they be? How much further would they be, you know, below where their expectations were heading into the season? Yeah, that is a very interesting question to ask, because you have to ask yourself, if Miguel Cabrera either A, does not exist, or B, does not play for the Detroit Tigers, do the Detroit Tigers still make a stab at Prince Fielder? That is one thing that I think they did solely based on having Miguel Cabrera, because they wanted these two power bats in the lineup, kind of like Braun and Fielder, now they have Cabrera and Fielder. And that's a very interesting point that you brought up. It really is, because you have to wonder what Detroit would do if they never even had Miguel Cabrera, if he was still with the Marlins.
Right.
So, you know, obviously that can go in many different ways, and that Pandora's box is just there. Still talking about the AL, talking about tonight's game, the wild card game between the Baltimore Orioles and the Texas Rangers. This game, the Orioles didn't know who they were going to start, and now they decided they're going to go with Joe Saunders. He's going to go up against Texas's Yu Darvish. Interesting matchup. When the Orioles played the Rangers earlier this season, they went to Texas, and they beat the ever-living daylights out of the Rangers, which I did not see happening.
Right.
However, they did not face Darvish. And in the same regards, you can say that Darvish has never faced the Orioles. And it's been proven so far. And I hate kind of basing things on stats, saying that's the way it is, because anything with stats is thrown out of the record books in this game.
Right.
But Darvish has typically done well against teams he's seen before. Now, however, he has played one AL East team once, the Rays, and he did well against them. So, who do you like in this game? Who wins it? Do the Orioles win it with Saunders and their mysterious offense that pops out of nowhere? Or do you like the Rangers with Darvish and their loaded lineup? Mind you, this is in Texas tonight.
Right. You know, and being in Texas, I don't know, you kind of have to give an edge to the Rangers. But you look at the way the Rangers finished this season, and, I mean, the fact that they're in this game at all says a lot.
yeah.
I mean, at what point in the season was that division not Texas's division to lose? And then it was just, it was little mistakes, and it was not showing up and not paying enough attention to the Athletics and to the other teams in their divisions, or in their division, rather, that were gunning for them the entire time. And I think that that, more than any of the stats, more than, you know, you Darvish pitching tonight, I think that says a lot about who they are as a team going into this postseason. They were the champions, and they played like they had already won that division.
Yeah, you get the two back-to-back World Series, and then the third year, you're fighting to get into the playoffs. That's a bit concerning for them.
In a season and in a division with a lineup and a team that you shouldn't have to fight like that. You know, it should just be natural. You should just be able to show up to play, and you should be winning ball games left and right. And I mean, the whole end of Texas' season seemed like one where they thought that this was just going to get handed to them, and they never even seemed that concerned when it wasn't.
Yeah, because you head into this last series of the season with Oakland, and then they realize, wow, this is a huge series. And Oakland comes in and sweeps them and wins the division. Because at this point, I think they were tied going into this series, and then Oakland won two games, and then they're up 10-8 in the series, and then Oakland won that final game. And that's something Texas, I think, was really blindsided by. Their pitching in September was absolutely awful. Derek Holland gave up 7 runs the other day and still won a game. So that tells you something about their pitching and about their offense. Darvish, on the other hand, has been really good in September. He had a very, very rough July and August, posting both above 5 ERAs in those months. Whereas in September, he went 3-0, a 2.21 ERA, 39 strikeouts and 36.2 innings pitched, an opponent's batting average of 160. Darvish really looked like the pitcher when he was with Nippon Ham Fighters last year, all 7 years they pitched with them in Japan. He looked like the pitcher that the Rangers spent the money to get.
Absolutely.
And for him to do that in the most crucial month of the season, it makes you wonder how well he can pitch under huge pressure. And tonight is a huge pressure game. Nolan Ryan, Ron Washington, they're putting a lot on Darvish's shoulders tonight. The fate of their season is on Darvish right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, that's kind of the way that this new wild card system is set up, you know? And I think my prediction, I think the Orioles are gonna sneak one past Texas tonight. I really do.
Really?
I think they have. I mean, you look at this team, the Fightin' Showalters. that's what they've done all year. You know, they've fought against teams that everyone in baseball thought they had no business competing against. They've beaten teams that they should have no godly business beating. And they ended up in the playoffs in a league where I'm sure probably about one out of every 8 fans will just leave the Orioles off the list of major league teams that they know.
You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. It's been that bad for Baltimore, and here they are in the wild card game, and you think that I just don't see them laying down just because it's Texas at Texas.
It'd be a great story to see if Baltimore could get past this huge giant in their way. And we've been talking about Texas for so long, I was talking about the Orioles. The Orioles have had this, I don't want to say magical season, because we knew with Buck Showalter that this team would turn around at some point.
Right.
Much like with the Nationals and David Johnson, we knew the Nationals would turn around at some point. So, for the Orioles, it's been really interesting. You have nobody on this team that really stands out in your mind, maybe other than Adam Jones and Nick Markakis, but he's hurt, and maybe Matt Wieters.
And Randy Wolf, who's also hurt.
you have Jim Johnson, who got, I believe, 50 saves this year. You know, you have a 51, I'm sorry. You have a lot on this team that you don't even know how the heck they're here. There's nothing in Baltimore that really scares you, that really threatens you. They have some of the worst pitching. Not really some of the worst, but not really that great. 14th overall in ERA, 21st in quality starts, 16th in whip, 16th in opponent's batting average. And their offense isn't much, you know, better either. 20th in batting average, 15th in runs scored, 23rd in on-base percentage, 11th in slugging. So, you know, there's really not anything about Baltimore that you go, wow, I don't want to play them. But at the same time, that makes you wonder, is this a team that's really more, gets more credit through the manager-wise, through Showalter, or is it just the fact that the Orioles have been winning games, like you said, they have no business winning, and just found ways to win them with these mediocre stats? I mean, I'm not discrediting Baltimore, but it's just something you don't see from this team. I mean, each team that's in the playoffs right now has a reason why they're there. Texas, their lineup. New York, their lineup. Detroit, their lineup and pitching. The A's, I would say they're pitching. They turned it around, you know, really well. Then even look at the National League. The Nationals, they're pitching. The Giants, they're pitching. The Reds, they're pitching and hitting. The Braves and Cardinals, they're hitting and pitching. Baltimore has nothing in my mind that stands out like any of those other teams. But for them to be here, that's a huge testament to their season and to the fact that they made Yankees fans hold their breath until literally Wednesday night. Because at that point, the Yankees still didn't know if they had the East won. So for them to do that to the Yankees, that's pretty incredible by Baltimore.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, maybe it's just a little bit of, you know, love for the little guy that makes me say, I want the Orioles to take this game. Because you look at a team like Texas that has spent money hand over fist to get people onto their side.
Yeah.
And you look at the Orioles that have just, like, they've taken the hand that they've been dealt, and, you know, they bet and bluffed their way all the way to the playoffs. And I think that's huge. I think that's wildly important for baseball, and I'd like to see that continue.
Yeah, because whoever wins this game obviously plays the Yankees starting Sunday, which is not going to be easy for either one of these two teams, since the Yankees will have some rest. They'll have time to rest up CeCe Sabathia and Hiroki Kuroda, whereas Baltimore and Texas are going to be on very short rest, having to travel. So, yeah, I mean, would I like to see Baltimore win personally? Yes and no. No, because I'm the Yankees fan. But yes, yes, because they've been a team that has been for so long been a laughingstock of the MLB, you know, multiple 90 loss seasons, even sometimes going into the hundreds. But the thing about Baltimore, and the thing really about any AL East team, is they can be so terrible in the season, but they will play their opponents in the AL East incredibly hard. I look at years past when the Rays were absolutely awful. They would give the Yankees heck. Boston would give the Yankees heck this season. Baltimore and Boston, they would play each other really rough. Baltimore and Tampa Bay. I mean, it's just, there are so many things about the AL East that they just play each other so hard. And Baltimore really learned from that. And yeah, I mean, I think they can go into this game and possibly win. But in the same regards, I think Darvish has been so good for Texas lately that it's going to be hard for the Baltimore lineup to overcome that without Nick Markakis.
Right.
Another quick AL game, just want to get into before we get into the NL stuff, is Oakland at Detroit on Saturday. You have Jared Parker against Justin Verlander at Detroit. Who do you have in that game?
In Oakland and Detroit?
Yes.
I think Detroit. I want Oakland to do well for the same reasons that I want Baltimore to do well. But legitimately, I think Detroit. Detroit kind of limped their way into the season, into the postseason rather, with very little fanfare. But I think now that they're here, I just see them kind of overwhelming Oakland.
You know, I don't know about that. I would say probably in game one, since they're facing Verlander, and they'll probably face they do face Scherzer, I believe, at a point on Wednesday, in Wednesday's game. Scherzer's been really good for the Detroit Tigers as well. Doug Fister's been kind of suspect a little bit. But Oakland, I don't know. They have a lot of fight. They have a lot of drive. Yoenis Cespedes has been a huge part of that. Coco Crisp has done well. Brandon Moss has done well. George Gutierrez, ex-Brewer, has done well. Their pitching has actually been really solid. Besides the a lot of runs A.J. Griffin gave up the other day against Texas, it's been really good. You've had A.J. Griffin. You've had Jared Parker. excuse me. You've had Blackley. Blackley. He's done really well as well. For Detroit, though, it's just, I think it's going to come down to, if Detroit wins it, it's going to be through a matter of offense, not pitching. Because I think they'll outslug Oakland, but I think pitching-wise, they're going to be very even, considering how well Oakland has been doing. And, I mean, taking over the West, that's incredible. And a lot of that was through pitching.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know. I think Oakland's a fantastic story. The fact they got into the divisional series is even better. And it would be so awesome for me to see an Oakland Baltimore National or American League Championship Series. For a while, it didn't look like it was going to fly that way, and that made me a little sad. But but that would be awesome. But I just think overall, Oakland's had a fantastic year. They've done great. I just think when it comes down to the playoffs, I trust the people in Detroit that have been there to get the job done better than the people that are on Oakland.
Yeah, because I mean, we do say the inexperience card comes into effect sometimes, and it kind of would with Oakland. They haven't been there in so long, but more so in the fact they have had more rookies on this team than any other team in baseball this season. I think it was 19 at one point. So I mean, they've had to play with a lot of different people who have never really had much major league experience. And for them to get to where they are, it's pretty impressive. I don't know if they're all on this roster now, obviously, but I think throughout the season they had 19 different rookies on the team at one point. So that's huge. And for them to give Oakland that kind of production to get to the playoffs, that speaks a lot about the future of Oakland. Heading, you know, south now, or actually we're still in the south a little bit, but heading west, east. I don't know my directions right now. We're heading to Atlanta now to see St. Louis and Atlanta. Kyle Lewis on the mound for St. Louis, Chris Medlin on the mound for Atlanta. Who you like in this game, Colin?
I like that is actually a really tough game. I like Atlanta because I don't like St. Louis.
Good answer.
Which is the best way I could put it, because both teams are surprisingly evenly matched. I think the edge, just on paper, probably goes to St. Louis. But Atlanta's hung tough all year, and I think that could go either way, but I'm pulling for Atlanta.
The only reason why I see Atlanta winning this game is because of Chris Medlin. He is in just this absolute monstrous tear of pitching. Kyle Lewis, yes, has done really well. But how many other seasons has Kyle Lewis done really well? I'm not saying it's a fluke season for Kyle Lewis, but it's kind of like Ari Dickey's season in a sense that people just can't really hit him. But I don't know. I really like what Chris Medlin has done. he was phenomenal. He had how many wins in a row that the Braves ended up setting a record in Major League Baseball that they won, I think, 23 consecutive games with him pitching in it, which set a record in baseball. Yeah, it's just, he went from being a reliever to a starter, and how can you not like the production that Chris Midland has given you? And just, he's on so much momentum right now, so much fire for him. And for the Braves in general, obviously they kind of had the wild card spot locked up, had a chance to get into the NL East, but I don't know, it's not that I don't like the Cardinals in this game, but I just don't see how Atlanta loses in Atlanta.
Right. I think, like you said, I think the way Atlanta's built, I think they're built to believe that they can win any one-game series with anybody in the league. And I have a hard time doubting them at that point.
Yeah, I mean, they've got one of the best closers in the league in Craig Kimbrell. Once you get to him, the games might as well be over.
Right.
He's actually in the Cy Young race, if you didn't know that. Yeah, just so many good things out of Atlanta. There really are.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, the great story with Chipper in his last year. You'd like to see him make the playoffs like he did for almost every other year he was ever in baseball. When the Braves were just that divisional powerhouse. But, you know, it'll be, it's definitely going to be a fun playoffs, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It would be more fun if Milwaukee was in it, but I'll take it the way it is.
And the last matchup we want to talk about is Cincinnati at San Francisco, which takes place Saturday night at San Francisco. You have Johnny Cueto on the mound for the Reds and Matt Cain on the mound for the Giants. Who do you like in this game?
Could you ask for a better pitching matchup?
No.
could you ask for more room for disaster for either pitcher also? I mean, you look at those lineups, you look at those pitchers, and I mean, you got to be in for the most exciting game in the playoffs without having any games played yet. That's my pick for by far the most exciting game. That's either going to be like 28-23. Or it's going to be like 1-0.
Yeah, you're either going to have football scores or a typical really good baseball score.
Right. I think that San Francisco probably pulls out that first game. But I think Cincinnati wins the war.
Yeah, because, you know, they've been struggling to see Bruce Bochy, try saying that five times fast, has been deciding who he's going to start in Game 3. As of right now, it is Tim Lincecum, but he's been thinking maybe he wants to start Vogelsong or Barry Zito. Either one of those two, I think, could get in there, but probably more so Barry Zito than anybody. I don't know. I like Cincinnati in Game 1 with Cueto on the mound, but he has been faltering lately. And Kane really has not been the same since his perfect game. After that, though, I don't know. You have really good matchups. You have Arroyo versus Bumgarner, a possible Lincecum versus Leitos. And then Game 4, if there is a Game 4, it would be, right now it's undecided for San Francisco against Homer Bailey, who just threw his no-hitter.
Right.
I don't know. I like Cincinnati in this series. But I think when it's all said and done, I just think San Francisco will have the stuff to take it. I really do. I like their pitching a little bit more. I know you get later in the game, you're going to see Sean Marshall and Jonathan Broxton and Aroldis Chapman for the Reds. But in later parts of the game for the Giants, you're still going to see, you know, Matt Cain and Madison Bumgarner maybe in the 7th or 8th inning. So I don't know. It's really a toss-up. I don't really have a clear cut in this choice. It's probably the hardest matchup in the playoffs right now is Cincinnati and San Francisco.
I would agree with that. It is a very, very difficult matchup to try to predict. But I think you look at the things that Todd Frazier has done, Jay Bruce, Joey Votto. You still have Brandon Phillips performing well. And then you have, you know, Johnny Cueto and Homer Bailey, kind of really cement, and Bronson Arroyo, really cementing that rotation. And then you have Aroldis Chapman and, like you said, Jonathan Broxton. I mean, not even all of those people have to show up and that team still wins.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the case a lot of the times for, excuse me, a lot of the times for the Reds, is they've just been able to pitch complete games. Homer Bailey, Johnny Cueto, it seemed like left and right for them.
Yeah.
For the Giants, though, yeah, obviously I think these two teams are almost identical in the sense that their power is almost the same, their pitching is almost the same, but I would take Joey Votto out of anybody in the lineup of the Giants, except for maybe Buster Posey. I think Joey Votto could take anybody in this lineup.
Right. And I mean, you're talking about you're talking about a team that in Cincinnati that was in the lead of this division for 114 days.
Yeah.
I mean, they never slipped further than five games behind. They were incredible, to say the least. I mean, other than the old Cincinnati champions, the wire-to-wire winners, you haven't seen a team like this in the Central for a while.
No, because the Central's always been between three or four teams, and for Cincinnati to have that kind of hold on it with nobody even close to them is actually rather incredible. People always say that the NL Central is one of the weakest divisions in baseball and blah, 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 blah.
AL Central has that crown yeah. Further notice.
Yeah, it really does. I don't know. I just was really impressed with Cincinnati and what they did. Obviously, we would like to see the Brewers sneak up somewhere at one point, but I didn't think that was really going to happen with just the phenomenal way that the Reds were playing. And even without Joey Votto, they still played incredibly well. So having him back, it just adds so much more firepower to their offense. You gotta like what Jay Bruce has been doing. You gotta like what Zach Cozart and Todd Frazier have been doing for the Reds. You know, there's a lot that goes right with them. Even Brandon Phillips has been doing really well. So, you know, it obviously sounds like the Reds could win this. But in the same regards, who would have thought in 2010 that the Giants were going to win at all? I mean, you look at the duct tape lineup they had, and they kind of have a little bit more power this year with guys like the addition of Hunter Pence and Marco Scudero. They add a little bit. But still, overall, you have some holes in there. You have Brandon Belt at first. You have Brandon Crawford at shortstop. You have some holes in their lineup. But those are adversities. They can come over. But if they take too long, Cincinnati's going to mop the floor with them easily.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I think we've got a healthy dosage of baseball in today's podcast.
That should be enough to tide you over for our new schedule, where we switch over to about every 2 weeks in the off season.
Yes, we will try and do every 2 weeks on Wednesdays. So our next show tentatively is scheduled for October 17th and then October 31st. Like Colin said, we're going to do that probably until April when the season starts up again. We're probably going to talk a little bit more about the fall leagues and maybe the playoffs as well. For the fall leagues, I forget what team it is the Brewers are on, because there's six different teams.
Phoenix Desert Dogs.
That's it. Keep your eyes out for the Phoenix Desert Dogs, which it does start up soon. I think in about 10 days or so.
October 9th, actually.
Oh, yeah. And then it goes through mid-November, so we're going to talk about that a little bit. Probably talk about guys like Hunter Morris and Brock Kligard and Johnny Helba, guys we want to keep eyes on maybe for next year. So, guys, it's been an incredible season. Thank you for listening to us, and stay tuned in 2 weeks.
Thank you, guys.